The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Fantastic.
Yeah, you built a patio over the weekend.
Got a lot of it done, yes.
Yes, it's really pretty. I stopped by to see it. It's nice.
It'll soon be time for a little bit of wine. And
yeah, that's right. Only now we're going to have to wait till next season to really break it in, right?
No, that's okay. It'll be heated somewhat.
How are you heating it?
Oh, we'll go into that later.
Oh, gee. Okay. So I take it you saw the WKYC piece on Cyclists versus Cars this week?
Yes.
Did you? Yeah. I'm such a TV star, huh?
Yes.
I thought the piece was pretty well produced.
They did a really nice job.
Yeah. It emphasizes the importance of awareness of cyclists by drivers and the importance of the cyclist's responsibility while on the road and interacting with cars. I think the video, as I remember, was 4 minutes long. If you're interested in the piece, you can go to WKYC.com and click on the Bike Lash link. There are some statistics and excellent information. And yes, you can actually see moi.
In the studio.
In the studio, right here in at WJCU. You also might remember the news item from last week about the councilman in Kansas City who was able to get a law passed that criminalized the act of harassment against cyclists and pedestrians.
Yep.
Well, guess what? We're going to talk to him tonight. Yes, indeed. He is on the show, Councilman John Sharp from Kansas City, Missouri. I'm going to ask him why he was so interested in this. Because my impression was, I'm not sure that he may or may not be a cyclist. Obviously, everybody's a pedestrian at some point. But I'm interested to hear what he has to say. Then we're going to go out to the left coast. And I have a question.
Yes.
Are you one of the many thousands of men who are planning to grow a mustache for Movember? Oh, wait. You already have a beard and a mustache, right?
Yes. I'd have to shave and start over.
Did you realize that Movember was Men's Health Month?
No, I didn't.
Yes. Movember. Better known as November. Well, we are going to speak with Dr. Dudley Danoff. He's a urologist who specializes in men's health issues. We're going to talk about symptoms men tend to ignore, and especially about prostate cancer, the type of tests, and testosterone replacement therapy. We're even going to talk about the little blue pill. Doesn't that sound like fun?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, we'll see. We'll have a little bit of news. I don't know how much time we're going to have. And then we're going to head up to Madison, Wisconsin in the second half of the show. We're going to take a deep look at a very difficult subject. Many years ago, I knew a handsome, smart, well-heeled young man who raced his bike, represented the most prestigious bike brands in cycling as an on-the-road rep, and who had a beautiful young family. Off and on over the years, we touched base, then lost contact until a LinkedIn notice asked if I'd like to connect with him, and I did. Within a short period of time, we'd arranged a time to chat and catch up, and what I didn't know was that Mike King's life had unraveled. He had been divorced, he'd lost all his money and possessions, he was estranged from his kids, he'd been in jail, and he had just become sober. So we're talking about going from the heights to the depths. Mike King is bipolar. His story is both enlightening and riveting, and I think that the fact that he tells it without any hint of shame or embarrassment, just lays the facts and reality on the table, will blow you away as it did me. And it'll give you a whole new appreciation of what someone who is going through this is all about. So no time to waste. We're going to say hello to Councilman John Sharp from Kansas City, Missouri. Councilman, thank you for joining me on the show this evening.
My pleasure.
In our newscast last week, we spoke about a new law that you have on the books in Kansas City that makes it a crime to harass cyclists and pedestrians. Can you tell us a little bit how that law came about and your role in it?
Well, there was a conference here that really attracted a large number of female cyclists, and they complained about the harassment and the threats and the dangerous activities that were directed their way while biking or while walking or jogging. So we did take that seriously and did pass an ordinance to allow prosecution by our city prosecutor of anyone who tried to intimidate or injure a person who was biking, walking, running, or operating a wheelchair, or for the purpose of doing the same to their service animal, if it was someone who is visually impaired.
Oh, my goodness. You know, you say service animal, and I know my listeners are going to go, oh, no, that people actually harass service animals? Is that possible?
Well, we knew there was a problem, but because we'd heard from complaints from time to time. But until we introduced this, quite frankly, I had no idea of the extent of the problem, and people have been injured as a result of some of these dangerous activities where people have swerved at them and then swerved away at the last moment or pulled up right beside them and then blasted a horn at them or hollered at them. And it really is just totally uncalled for, and it's dangerous, and people have gotten hurt, and people could get killed.
Well, you know, there are several other communities around the country that have a similar law in the books, but they don't criminalize it. You actually make it a crime to do this. And tell me how long it took to get this law on the books for your council.
Well, it was a matter of weeks. It wasn't a real long time, although we had some opposition, and some people were concerned that somehow this was inhibiting free speech, but we made it clear it was only if you did these things to intimidate or injure, and it is punishable by a fine of from $50 to $500 or by imprisonment for up to 180 days or both such fine and imprisonment. Now, I wouldn't imagine many of these cases would actually result in someone being put in municipal detention, but if it was serious enough, they certainly could.
So it's swerving, it's throwing things, but I do understand that if you shout at somebody, then you begin to get into that whole free speech thing.
Well, you do, but if it's for the purpose of intimidation.
Oh, okay.
Then it is something else. If someone just hollers at somebody, or is acting like a jerk, you really can't criminalize that and have it stand up. But if they're doing it for the purpose of intimidation, there's a lot of case law dealing with that. A lot of it's based on Klan activities from cross burnings and things like that. So there's pretty clear, sound case law that if you're doing things like this, like driving at somebody and then swerving away at the last minute or honking at them or throwing something at them or shouting at them to intimidate them, that is not constitutionally protected.
If something like this happens and nobody is injured, as in nobody falls down and nobody's been hit or otherwise, you know, impaired, and the person takes off, you know, most of this happens with cars, unfortunately, automobiles against cyclists, pedestrians, wheelchairs. How is it that somebody is going to be prosecuted? How can you actually get to this person?
Well, if the person who is a victim or a witness gets the license number,
okay,
they could then go to the police and file a complaint, and if they appeared credible and had the license number, that complaint it would then be issued. Now, if there are areas, and we've heard some reports that there are certain areas where this happens day after day after day, basically at the same time, including instances where people are going to school or ladies are walking their kids to school, We have talked to the chief of police and to the majors who are in charge of certain patrol divisions in the department, and they could actually assign officers to some of these areas if we're having a continual problem at roughly the same time at roughly the same area.
Do you have any surveillance cameras in any of the areas that might help in these situations?
Well, there are quite a few cameras around, not only the city has, but businesses have, but the city is adding mobile cameras that can be moved from one location to the other. The Police Foundation has raised money for that, so that is another option available to us.
And so my last question is, has anybody yet been prosecuted under this law?
Not yet, but, you know, it was only recently passed. It was passed on October 2nd, it doesn't even go into effect till 10 days later, so it was October 12th when it was actually in effect. But we do think there will be some prosecutions under it, although we would rather not. We hope that there was quite a bit of publicity about it, and hopefully that alone will deter some behavior. But I got some pretty obnoxious emails from people who really had the attitude that bicyclists don't belong on the streets. You know, people in wheelchairs don't belong on the streets, even though they may live in an area where there's no sidewalk. So it was pretty clear there's some pretty obnoxious, dangerous drivers out there.
Well, you know, we report on it, unfortunately, all the time. And we were very pleased to see this law passed in Kansas City. And we're here in Cleveland, and we're looking at everything that goes on all over the country and all over the world to protect cyclists. And I really appreciate you bringing this one up to your council and passing it. So thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your interest, and thanks for everything you do to make it a Cleveland a safer community.
Well, thanks. And you have a great afternoon.
Okay.
All righty. Bye, Councilman.
Bye-bye.
Councilman John Sharp joined me right after his legislative meeting to talk about the new law in Kansas City to protect cyclists and walkers and service dogs. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I did. I think it's great that we have council people. And he didn't say that he was a cyclist and he didn't come from that viewpoint. It was something that needed to get done.
Well, I thought it was interesting. He said he got all these obnoxious emails and he found them really upsetting. I'm really pleased that, you know, he has common sense.
I think it's fabulous to hear that the police organizations are actually providing cameras, mobile cameras, that'll help out in that area. And on top of that, again, big advocate I am for cameras that are on bikes or on helmets to help, and I'm sure that'll help out. And at some point in time, the morons on the cars, not everybody in a car is a moron, but those in cars that are morons that just really don't get that every time you see a cyclist or somebody walking, that's one less car in front of you.
Right.
It's really simple. But it's great to see in Kansas City, at least they're making progress.
And they are. And we're going to progress ourselves. We're going to take a very quick break and we'll be right back to talk with Dr. Dudley Smith about, ready? Penis power. Got your attention. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Good afternoon, Dr. Danoff. Thank you for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So you're out in L.A. and
yes.
Your work is specifically in the area of urology.
Yes, I am a board certified urologic surgeon and practice at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in sunny Southern California, L.A.
But you're not originally from California.
How could you ever guess that? No, you can take the boy out of Brooklyn, but you can't take Brooklyn out of the boy. That's
you
what my
got
kids
it.
Say.
That's exactly right.
Although I've been here for more than 30 years by way of Princeton and Yale and Columbia, but I still speak like I came from Brooklyn. Sorry.
Yep. Yep. I lived in Cincinnati most of my life in Ohio, and people still say, are you from Philadelphia? Which, of course, I am. So years ago, you may remember this, ABC did a lengthy piece about the relationship between impotence and riding a bicycle. And then all the stuff happened. You know, it hit the fan. Women, as well as men, were all upset. And there came a whole new era of bicycle saddles and better bike positioning and a real conversation. But you believe, and I believe, that men tend to ignore certain issues that they should discuss. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Many of our listeners are men. Most are over 40. What are the specific symptoms men tend to ignore?
Well, first of all, every man wants to catch, you know, the touchdown in the final seconds of the Super Bowl. So men are very, very reluctant to talk about any ills or any discomfort. They all believe they're supermen. They all have to be pushed to the doctor by their girlfriend or their wife or their significant other. So at least in terms of urologic conditions, I mean, the things that men ignore: urinary frequency, urinary urgency, getting up at night, painful urination, blood in the urine. So those are the things which are telltale signs to the urologist. And those are the things that men should be going to their urologist to investigate.
And what are some of the consequences of ignoring these things? What are the kinds of things that these things might indicate?
Well, certainly one of the things is prostate cancer. I mean, prostate cancer is a silent disease. So when many men get up at night and have a thin and narrow urinary stream or incomplete bladder emptying, those are signs of an enlarged prostate and not of cancer. But in evaluating an enlarged prostate, we often make the diagnosis of prostate cancer. And if you have silent enlargement of your prostate and a backup of urine, you will end up in kidney failure. So these are all telltale signs which can have serious consequences.
Does everyone who has an enlarged prostate have some consequence that needs to be treated? Are there times when you just don't necessarily treat? You might just watch something that's going on?
Oh, absolutely, both in benign and in malignant conditions. Enlargement of the prostate is a normal process of aging, but not all prostatic enlargement needs treatment. And even if it does, we can give a medicine which will shrink the prostate, or as we describe, open the hole in the donut and allow the egress of urine from the bladder more easily. And of course, we have the other situation, particularly in bicycle riders, where you have this symptom called hypogonadism or low serum testosterone, in which the libido is diminished, grumpy old man syndrome, a little fat around your middle. So all of those things can be investigated and can be treated.
Talk to me a little bit about TRT, testosterone replacement therapy. There seems to be more talk about that these days. And you are very cautionary in telling people they should go ahead and do this.
Yes. I, as all responsible health professionals, I mean, TRT or testosterone replacement therapy is a good thing if it's properly done, but it's a bad thing if it's improperly done. No man should have his testosterone replaced if he has a normal circulating serum testosterone. And the way men get into trouble is they try to pump it up. They try to be ultra muscular, and they try to get their testosterone to the upper limits of normal or even beyond the limits of normal. And that can result in serious cerebrovascular effects, strokes, all sorts of cardiac issues. So testosterone replacement is fine, but it's got to be done professionally. It's got to be done by somebody who knows what they're doing, and it's got to be done in the setting of a low circulating serum testosterone.
At what point should men begin to be tested for any of these urological possible issues?
Because the main issue that we worry about is prostate cancer, because as I said previously, prostate cancer is a silent disease, and by the time it's symptomatic, it's incurable. So certainly every man between the age of 40 and 65 should have a PSA, which is called a prostate-specific antigen. It's a screening blood test. It's not perfect, but it's the best that we have. Should have a yearly digital rectal exam. That is an examination with a gloved finger to examine the prostate, analogous to a breast exam in a woman, and a prostate ultrasound. And that will bring about the early diagnosis and curable stage of a prostate cancer. And certainly men starting age 40 to about age 65 or 70, if you're an African-American Or if you have a male relative with prostate cancer, it probably should be done starting age 35. But that's the way we prevent deaths from prostate cancer. And since the advent of PSA, this screening test, prostate cancer deaths have been diminished by about 50%. It's really remarkable.
I would say that had that test been available when my father was alive, he would have lived a lot longer. I truly believe that. So I have one last question. I have a question about the little blue pill.
Yes.
And all these other medications that are continuously being kind of hawked on TV.
Right.
Do you have any idea of what the real statistical number of people who actually experience erectile dysfunction is in this country, or are we trying to sell a lot of Viagra and Cialis?
Well, let me start with the end. The companies are certainly trying to sell as much Viagra and Cialis as they can, and it is truly a billion dollar drug. So it depends what, you know, we define as erectile dysfunction. I mean, is the failure of your penis to do what you hope it will do, is it age appropriate? Is it relation appropriate? I mean, it's not going to be the same, you know, at 20 as it will be at 50, and it's not going to be the same, you know, with a partner that you've had for 20 years as opposed to, you know, the first night out with, you know, something new and something fresh. I would say a fair estimate that men over 60, about 40% of them have some element of erectile dysfunction, meaning that their performance is not age appropriate. And you have to remember that these are drugs of performance. They are not drugs of desire. The problem is, even younger guys, even guys who don't have real ED, are taking these drugs because they want to be, you know, better performers. They want to be the weekend warrior. So it's the number, the amount of those pills that are sold and promoted is way in disproportion to the real incidence of erectile dysfunction.
Is there any danger to taking these drugs?
Very, very low risk. I mean, that's why it's a $1 billion industry.
Yeah, no,
I mean, certainly in younger men, or if they're doing pills and poppers or doing something else, there is a risk of what we call priapism. That is an erection that lasts longer than 4 hours. You know, that can do permanent damage. The risk is very small if these drugs are used judiciously and according to the label, the warnings on the label. They are very safe drugs. They're basically increased blood flow. So they increase blood flow to the heart. And Cialis is being promoted and widely used as a daily dosed pill. So many men over 40 take a 5-milligram pill of Cialis. It's been approved by the FDA for prostatic enlargement. So they're both, quote, ready for action anytime the need arises, and also beneficial to the prostate. So these are enormously profitable and effective drugs and unusually safe.
Wow. It doesn't sound like there's a huge downside, no pun intended.
No, there isn't.
Well, Dr. Danoff, I really appreciate you talking with me today. I know you're busy, and I think these are important things for our listeners to know. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And let's do it again, Deanne, and say hello to all my friends in Cleveland.
Will do. Thank
okay.
you. All righty.
Okay. Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Dudley Danoff joined me from his office in Los Angeles, California. I'm not going to ask the question. Go ahead, say something.
No, go ahead, ask.
I don't know what to ask.
I mean, it's obviously a subject that we need to talk about.
It is. And I was really curious because, you know, these ads are just ad nauseum. They're on constantly. And what he's saying is that the drugs are safe and that I sort of got towards the end there that they might even be somewhat healthy for the prostate.
Right. And that was it.
That's even weirder.
Right. That was the interesting part that I took from that. Again, I'm glad we had the opportunity to talk to him. And this really is, it's a subject that all cyclists, everybody, whether you're a cyclist or not, you need to address.
Right. Okay. Mr. Tim, you ready to do a little bit of news?
Absolutely.
Well, let's do it. What you got?
The results are in. Drink coffee and ride faster. Cyclingweekly.co.uk. A Spanish lab gave a group of amateurs a combo of caffeine and carbohydrate gel and has found that they rode significantly better than others who had smaller doses or none at all. the big hit of caffeine gave them staying power. But how big was the hit? Scientists from the University of Alicante gave the volunteers measured amounts of caffeine for every kilo of their body weight. The doses were taken 70 minutes before the experiment. They had to ride easily for an hour at 70% of their VO2 max, followed by a ramp test to exhaustion. Riders who had just 0.2 milligrams of caffeine per kilo didn't perform any better than those who had no caffeine at all. Those who got a whopping 0.7 milligrams per kilo of body weight were clear winners at the end of the ramp test, riding significantly longer than the rest of the people.
Well, there you have it. This comes from Velo News. After talking with Dr. Danoff, and we're talking about issues for men.
Mm-hmm.
This is issues for cyclists. It has to do with emboli, pulmonary embolism. Pulmonary embolism, a silent killer. What cyclists should know. It's by David Stanley. Again, it comes from Velo News. And there is the cautionary editor's note that says the article is a general overview of pulmonary emboli, does not constitute medical advice. Always consult your physician if you think you are suffering from this or any other medical condition, which, of course, is always good advice. So pulmonary emboli are silent killers, often with little prior warning. Nearly 300,000 people are killed every year by blood clots, which lodge in their lungs. And there is no greater cause of sudden death in the healthy population than a pulmonary embolism. First, a clot called a deep vein thrombosis forms, often in the calf. The DVT travels from the veins to the right side of the heart, which pumps the clot to the lungs. Untreated, this blocks blood flow to the lungs and can ultimately cause cardiac arrest. In total, over 900,000 people are stricken with pulmonary emboli every year. Many of those hit are otherwise healthy, athletic people. PEs are not unheard of in the peloton. Rwandan cycling pro Adrian Nyanshuti, and we knew he was off the bike for a while because of this, lost his 2013 season because of his pulmonary embolism. Vuelta a España champion Chris Horner suffered one in 2011, and top professional Frank Vandenbroek wasn't so lucky. His embolism was fatal. There's a lot more information, but I urge anybody who wants to know more about this. It's an excellent article. Again, it is in Velo News. It was published on the 21st of October by David Stanley. Pulmonary embolism, a silent killer, what cyclists should know. We are going to take a real break, and we will be back to talk with Mike King. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're back. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
We're going to take a deep look at a very difficult subject. Mike King is bipolar. His story is both enlightening and riveting, and I think that the fact that he tells it without any hint of shame or embarrassment will blow you away as it did me. And it'll give you a whole new appreciation of what someone who is going through this is all about. Hi, Mike. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
It is my pleasure. We've known each other a really long time. We lost contact for a few years. And when we reconnected a few weeks ago, I learned some things about you and what's been going on in your life that I think our listeners might want to hear. And you've been kind enough to share them with me. So let's tell our listeners a little bit about Michael King, where you hail from and your cycling career and sort of how we met, which was, you know, in the context of retail, actually.
Sure. I was raised on the North Shore of Chicago, very affluent background, and found bicycle racing as an outlet for my energy. Had no idea what I wanted to study, so I didn't go to college. Went to California after graduating high school and
found myself in the spring of 77 racing alongside of our 76 Olympians, George Mount and Mark Pringle, and getting lit up by a young junior by the name of Greg LeMond. As the Buddhists say, I picked my parents well. My mother was an AAU champion swimmer, and my father traveled with the Air Force basketball team, both very notable athletes in their time. And I had that foundation and came back to the Midwest after that winter in California and proceeded to get second in my first Illinois State Championships, was designated as a Category 1 cyclist, and went from there. I was able to race my bicycle for my living for 10 years. Raced my bicycle on three different continents, was a member of the U.S. National Cycling Team, participated in the Pan Am trials, the Olympic trials, raced for an Italian trade team, won something in the vicinity of 150 bicycle races over the course of that time, and had a great education, a far better education than I think I would have had any other way.
True that.
Trying to figure out what was next in my life. I had contracted mononucleosis, and my cycling career was, I felt, winding down. And I was in my sponsor's bicycle store in Evanston, Illinois, Lee Katz, who doesn't get as much credit as he deserves for being a pioneer in cycling. And a rep walked in the door. And you either dealt with this individual or you didn't get anything done. I thought, huh. A little epiphany moment, a little aha moment. I said, I can do that. And I went to the trade show in Anaheim that year in 1988 and cozied up to a friend of mine, Jonathan Boyer, who I had raced with. And Jock had a small distribution company and said, Jock, I want to be a rep for you. And he said, great, Mike, you can have everything east of the Mississippi.
And that's how we met.
That's how we met, yes.
How old were you when you started repping so that your cycling career was winding down and now this professional career was kind of winding up?
28, I believe. Okay. I was. I just turned 28 at that time.
Were you married then?
I wasn't, though. I had met my future wife, Lisa, in the bike shop that sold her a bicycle. And
funny how those things happen.
Yeah. And I've always considered myself the most fortunate man on earth, if for no better way to explain it. But I was in the right place at the right time, so I was the first rep. It's hard for people to get their head around this, but I was the first rep for Pearl Izumi. I was the first rep for Cliff Bar. I was the only rep for Bridgestone Cycle. So I literally sold the first pair of Pearl Izumi bike shorts in the territory and the first Cliff Bar and had a wonderful career spanning 25 years where I was able to make a good living and build brands from zero to substantial sales as a commission-only sales rep.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at who's a sales rep today and what sales reps are required to do and how they're hired, life is so different today from when you did it. And I know several reps who did extremely well in those years, you know, West Coast Cycle reps and Western States Imports reps. But you were one of those independent reps who, you know, glommed onto some of the best brands in the market.
Yeah, I really don't have anything that I can cite, but just being very fortuitous and having the benefit of not really understanding risk, which came to fore later in my life, but I had no idea what I could not do. So I took things at zero at the very ground floor of opportunity and ran with them.
I'm speaking with Michael King. We are going to get into a little more of current things that are going on in his life. He was a Category 1 racer. He was one of my reps in the early years. He was always one of the handsomest guys I knew, too. You're still good looking. You're 55 now?
I am.
Okay. So when did things start to change and what happened. So it put that a little bit into context, and let's start about, I know you're willing to talk about this sort of downward spiral. It's a very, very tough subject.
Yeah, the way I view it now in the context that I have with this experience is that I had a very low bottom, as they say, but I also had very high highs. What I didn't know, but it is hereditary in my family, is that I prefer to view as a gift, not a malady, but that I am bipolar. And that allowed me to take many of these risks that I cited, both in my athletic career and my professional career, when I was hypomanic. I was very, very creative. I didn't have a filter that said stop. So whether it was in cycling, it was very difficult to beat me to the last corner because I didn't understand risk, or whether someone was giving me the opportunity for a brand new line with no existing sales. By the same token, I didn't understand that there was a downside. That pendulum, as I've come to understand it, started to swing wider and wider. I used to have little bouts of depression that I thought were maybe seasonally affective disorder or just mild depression. And I've come to understand we're not just simply that. And there was a series of events in my life that I'll call or characterize as cascading stress. And in the midst of a very difficult 2-year divorce, I lost Perluzumi. When there's an expression in sales that you don't get fired, you lose a line by taking your eye off the ball. And that was the cornerstone of my business at the time. And though I was able to prosper for another decade after that and succeed immensely with Delta Bicycles and other lines, that was a blow. Getting divorced was a blow. These periods of depression lasted for longer and longer periods of time. I went to different psychologists and psychiatrists, tried just about every different antidepressant known to man. None felt good. They all felt terrible, in fact, and was able to pick myself up by the bootstraps or in some manner get back to work, and the depression left and the mania resumed. Now, that pendulum swung wider and wider, and in about 2009, I went into a period of deep depression where I really felt my brain was broken. I couldn't understand why I couldn't remember the room I was given by the hotel clerk minutes before. I couldn't stay awake behind the wheel of my car, even though I'd had plenty of rest. People suggested that it was maybe something with my thyroid or vitamin D, or they were grasping at straws, as was I. What's challenging with bipolar disease is it's not easily recognizable unless you're off the rails, as I will characterize it, either at the low end, which often ends in death by suicide, or on the high end, which is full-blown, menacing, manic behavior, a la Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Charlie Sheen. Very scary behavior. And people would come in to try to assist me, whether it be sales managers or friends, and I looked fine. I didn't appear to have anything outwardly broken, and they all said the same thing, including my father, just go back to work, you'll be fine.
Yeah, right.
And in the midst of that deep depression in 2009, I was awarded my 18th National Salesman of the Year award was from Felt at that time, and I was looking around the room like, Michael, who are you calling? I couldn't hardly get out of my own way, but I was still winning awards. But was in this state that I characterize as having a broken brain. The pendulum swung the other way in the spring of 2010, and the mania resumed, but this time it went from just hypomanic behavior, which had served me so well, to full-blown menacing behavior. I shaved my head, and in a period of 25 days, I committed 7 felonies in 5 different counties in 2 different states, and was committed to a mental health institution because I was a threat to myself or others. And that's a pretty significant event, but one that was necessary and frankly saved my life. I was put on lithium the first day I was under a psychiatrist's care in the hospital for the criminally insane.
Where was this?
It was in the Mendota Mental Health Institute here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, in Madison. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said something to me about when Robin Williams died. You said that you recognized what would cause him to take his own life. So what happens, and I'm not asking for the medical what happens, but you related so many incidences to me that were so uncharacteristic of Mike King, not anything I would ever have thought of that would be something you would do. And there you were doing these things. What was it about Robin Williams' death that suddenly now you're speaking out about all of this?
Well, one of the advisors or reporters, I think it was Dr. Sanjay Gupta, came on CNN and spoke of the term of cascading stress. And I immediately had the image of dominoes. And though I don't have any idea what sent me into this period of manic behavior that was all set aside by not guilty of reason of mental disease, not defect. Disease is treatable. Something tipped me into this period that was completely out of character. I had heard at the time after Robin Williams took his life that his little current sitcom had been canceled. And I had one of those epiphanies. I thought, well, that certainly could be it. It doesn't take much to tip the dominoes, but if they're set up a certain way and you have the hereditary components, you also throw in what they call in the medical profession a dual diagnosis. If you have alcoholism, which is also hereditary in my family, I used marijuana for many, many years as my friend to get me up when I was down and down when I was up. You throw in, nitro on top of glycerin or tip those dominoes, and there they go. It's no stopping them until there's some sort of bitter end.
I'm speaking again with Mike King. We're talking about bipolar disorder and how it manifested itself in his life and what he's doing now, which is rebuilding your life, actually. You made a comment about, I think it was a statistic, about how many suicides probably have some sort of root in this kind of mental disorder, this bipolar disorder.
Yeah, I paid attention through all the therapy I've been given, though I fought the diagnosis and tried to drink away the memories. But one of the statistics that I read that popped out at me is something of an oxymoron, that 30% of successful suicides, now I know that sounds preposterous, but
yeah,
30% of successful suicides are committed by those who are bipolar, meaning we are the kind of guys that know how to step in front of a train. Robin Williams knew how to kill himself. He was clearly manic and struggled with alcohol and drugs. We are the guys that actually get it done, unfortunately. We're not the type that slash our wrists and call 911 and go through some sort of a pity party cycle. We managed to find that end game, which is a very, very dark concept. But it struck me as one that was, well, not sobering at the onset, but one that's I take very seriously now.
Do you think, besides the genetic component, that there is a certain type of personality that is more prone to a bipolar disorder, like very high IQs or very active imaginations? Is there something else that dovetails with the genetic component that sort of tips that scale in one direction or another?
Well, I don't think you can separate the genetics from the disease. I think Dr. Gupta put a bipolar brain on the screen, and I think it was when Charlie Sheen was going off the rails a few years ago, and they showed what happens when a bipolar guy or girl is in a depressed state. All the activity in the brain is in the frontal lobe. That's your filter saying stop, stop, stop. No, no, no. I couldn't tell whether to put on black pants or brown pants. When a bipolar guy or girl is in a manic state, all your activity is in your cerebral cortex. That's your creative center saying go, go, go. So that's a period where a Robin Williams, for example, or a Jimi Hendrix, or, you know, I'm not brilliant like those two, but, you know, I had my shining moments were very creative because there's no filter. So you're accessing, when I say bipolar is actually a gift, I was able to access as much of my brain as possible to its fullest in its creative realm in the cerebral cortex for long periods of time and was able to outwork people, but I was also able to find solutions to issues that others either didn't see or were only evident to me because I did not have that frontal lobe activity that was cautionary for most people to, you know, look both ways before they cross the street. It's for a bipolar person, it's one or the other. There isn't that nice balance that you see in the brain of a quote-unquote healthy person.
Once you were diagnosed, once they put you on lithium, and I would like to say something about lithium because you said something that was very interesting, and you said lithium doesn't have side effects. Lithium itself is the problem. Explain what you mean by that and what lithium does, what it is that it either balances or, I mean, it's a nasty drug. It's a nasty an element, right?
Yes, it's on the periodic table and okay. It's in your phone, and no one would want to take it willingly if they knew that it causes liver damage, not can cause. It can cause brain damage if you're taking it above the therapeutic range. It's got some serious effects. I changed my verbiage with the help of a particular psychiatrist when I was complaining about some of what I considered the negative effects of lithium, the lethargy that I experienced, the constant hunger, the sometimes feeling dull when I used to always feel bright. And she stopped me and she said, Michael, stop. There are just effects. You take a drug, whether it's aspirin or lithium, anything along the range, and there will be effects. There are very few drugs, if any, that hit the intended target and only that target. Every drug has some other effect. So just remove the side effect adjective out of that equation, and lithium keeps me within a amplitude, is how I put it, that's acceptable. I'm neither too high nor too low. I'm considered pretty stable. No one in the medical health profession will ever deem me stable, which for a while was frankly unsettling because I feel completely stable. But because I've had this period of instability, no one will ever say, hey, you're cured, you're stable. And I accept that now. So I'm pretty stable. And I religiously take my lithium. As I mentioned, there was a period there after I had virtually destroyed everything that was important in my life, my family, my relationship with my children, my friends, and my career, that I tipped into alcoholism. I think that's a progressive disease like diabetes. You can have the hereditary components and not be a full-blown alcoholic. There's no such thing as a functioning alcoholic, but I went from a few drinks a night to a 6-beer a night to a 12-beer a night guy, in a very short period of time, and I know exactly why I did it, but it didn't help me in any manner of speaking, caused me to wallow in self-pity and victim energy, and that wasn't productive at all. So I've been in recovery, clean and sober, for about 13 and a half months, and I'm now very careful with my health. But lithium is part of my daily diet. Exercise, yoga, a very clean diet, plenty of sleep, and I don't take my stability for granted any longer.
So let's talk about your day-to-day right now. You are working again some.
I am. I'm currently juggling a couple of retail jobs, which are fun for me. I didn't have any idea. Well, to be rigorously honest, I thought working retail on the other side of the counter would be somehow beneath me. But I love people, and I enjoy working retail. And the only thing that I really had to adjust to was the pay scale, which is dramatically different.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. So I'm very fortunate that to be given the opportunity to work retail at a bicycle shop here in Madison, Wisconsin, and an outdoor store also here in Madison. So,
are you riding your bike?
I am. I'm getting back to enjoying riding my road bike for pleasure. I ride one of three bicycles everywhere, so I've got a couple different commuter bicycles for doing my errands and grocery shopping and what have you, and I only put the road shoes and what I call the monkey suit on usually about once a week to go out on the road bike. But I rode 4 hours this past Sunday, and I'm very fit. It's just the same receptors that gave me such a great endorphin rush for that decade of bike racing are the same endorphins that I dulled with a lot of just pot and alcohol use over decades, and they're slow to reawaken. So I'm enjoying my bicycles, and I'm enjoying yoga, and I'm enjoying swimming laps and being fit. But it's a more subtle rush than I was used to taking. I was used to taking a shortcut to get there for so long.
If you were to give someone who doesn't understand what you went through, if you were to say, this is what I want you to know about bipolar disorder, what could you sum up? You know, I mean, your life is sort of back on an even keel right now. It's not the highs that you had or the lows that you had. But tell me what you'd like people to know about your experience.
That's a challenging one. What comes up for me is that there's a stigma that is associated with bipolar disease and also schizophrenia that is not the same stigma that exists with just run-of-the-mill depression. And it's not a weakness. It's not anything that anyone should be ashamed to discuss. It's something that people shy away from, looking at that 5 inches between your ears as part of your overall health. But if there's a genetic component of bipolar disease in your family, there's a darn good chance that you've been touched or have that cursing through your veins as well. So it's not a death sentence. There are a number of treatments available which are very effective. I feel great. I don't suffer from any pauses in conversation or any challenge in in aptitude, but there's this, because of how it's been characterized, I think, in the media and in movies, that people shy away from the guy that's been diagnosed as bipolar. He potentially, as I have, has been institutionalized, and they'll always keep their guard up. And I think that's ignorance, unfortunately. And so it's a process of education. And I've just had to be an example, not a warning, for someone that's, you know, gone through this and come out the other side.
Well, I would like to tell you that your willingness to tell the story to everybody who's listening is beyond helpful and beyond magnanimous. And I so appreciate it. When you told me the story personally, I was at first stricken, you know, just because I know you. I've known you for 30 years. And having you repeat it now in the way we just went through it gives me even a better understanding. And, you know, you need to be the person out there talking to people, not just to me on this show, but to a lot of people in a lot of ways, because you understand what's going on and you are so eloquent in being able to tell it.
Thank you, Ty. And I'm looking for what, you know, is next. What I characterize as the third chapter in my life.
Yep.
And I want to help people. And if I can help one person, that would be great. If I could help many, that would be even better. But it shouldn't be a phobia about looking at this. The same way we look at any other disease, you know, if it's cancer, if it's, you name it, if it's diabetes, if it's anything else, we look at it, we analyze it, we make changes, we address it, we manage it. Bipolar isn't a rung on the ladder that I chose to pull. I got there in essence by no fault of my own, but then I made a series of bad decisions to accelerate it. But very few people are immune to making a few bad decisions. It's just, if you have these markers within you, you know, in my case, those bad decisions can lead to catastrophic circumstances.
I want to wish you so much luck. We will stay in touch and keep doing the good stuff. Stay on your bike. Keep doing yoga. All those things are so awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Diana. I appreciate your support.
And take care of yourself. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Diana. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mike King joined me from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. As I said at the very beginning of this interview, it was going to be a hard interview to do. It was going to be a hard subject to discuss. But the truth is, Mike made it very easy. And if, as he said, one person can be helped by what he had to say, we will have done a great thing. That's the end of our show for this week. I hope you have an opportunity to go for a ride. It's not too rainy. It's not too cold. And thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show on The Outspoken Cyclist. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.